Fiona Kelly's here now to tell us what it says in today's papers.
The liquidation of the Bearhaven Credit Union in Cork provides the lead story in today's Irish Independent. The paper takes the line that the central bank has urged the country's 3 million credit union members not to panic, since yesterday's news does not have any impact on any other credit union. On its front page, meanwhile, the Irish Examiner reports that the board of the credit union in question has said that it is not in the public interest to wind it up. The Examiner leads today with a special county-by-county health report, and the paper has also published a special supplement to accompany that report, which finds that death rates from breast cancer are highest in Waterford. The highest rate of suicide is in Cork City, while Limerick City has the highest rate of infant mortality. Minister told to rein in spending and allow for tax cuts. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times, which reports from yesterday's last Cabinet discussion before the summer holidays. The Irish Daily Mail leads with comments made by Robert Watt, the Secretary General of the Department of Public Expenditure at the McGill Summer School yesterday, that it should be made easier to sack underperforming civil servants. And today's Herald leads with that high-speed crash between Gardaí and burglars just outside Portlaoise yesterday. The Irish Daily Star leads today with a story which claims that cash-strapped prison bosses have drafted in an inmate who's currently serving a 5-year sentence for drug crimes to drive a bus with other inmates on board from Mountjoy Prison to Thornton Hall. The inquest into the death of Peaches Geldof, which receives coverage in all of this morning's papers, meanwhile, provides a lead story in today's Irish Sun. The paper reports that Peaches Geldof overdosed on high-strength heroin after hiding the drug in her loft and lying that she had quit. And the paper also notes that the strength of her overdose was 10 times that which killed her mother, Paula Yates, who also died of an overdose in 2000. Back in the front of the Times, it was reported that yesterday's meeting of the Banking Inquiry Advisory Group advised that the investigation should look back over a 20-year period. And that paper also is a front-page story about how KPMG, as the liquidator of Irish Nationwide, is suing its former managing director, Michael Fingleton, along with its board and other executives, over a loan to a French ski resort. Elsewhere this morning, there are a number of obituaries to Louis Lenton following his death yesterday. Dolores Kane's failed application at Glenties District Court to have her driving licence returned halfway through her 4-year ban for drink driving is reported in a number of this morning's papers. And the announcement of the Booker Prize long list also receives plenty of coverage today. Writing in the Times, Eileen Battersby describes the list, which contains two Irish authors, Joseph O'Neill and Niall Williams, as uninspired. And she puts her money on Australian author Richard Flanagan, while the Mail reports that Joseph O'Neill is the bookie's favourite. One in four people living in Dublin are millionaires, with the capital ranking 13th in a global listing of millionaire residents. That's in The Independent. And The Independent and Examiner both report today that Gardaí and the GAA are investigating a fracas at an under-16s hurling match, which had to be abandoned just outside Cork City on Sunday night, after which three people had to be treated in Cork University Hospital for minor injuries. The Times and Independent both report today on how vandals sprayed red paint all over the newly located Molly Malone statue at Suffolk Street in Dublin yesterday morning, although the graffiti was removed by mid-afternoon. And the good weather provides front page pictures in both the Times and Independent today, who run with shots taken by Colin Keegan at a sun-kissed Portmarnock beach in Dublin. But finally, if you're finding it difficult to sleep in the heat, the Mail has a piece today which offers some suggestions. We're told that sleeping naked is not a good thing to do, since pyjamas serve to draw the sweat away from your body at night. Remedies which you might try, however, include relocating to a cooler room downstairs in your house to sleep, taking a cold shower before bedtime, sleeping in a hammock, and chilling your sheets just before bedtime in the fridge or freezer.
Thank you, Fiona. We'll have more advice on surviving the heat a little bit later on.
Brian Jennings has the news in full.
The United Nations Humanitarian Chief Lady Amos has warned that Palestinian civilians in Gaza face an increasingly desperate situation as Israel's offensive against militants continues. Health officials in Gaza say more than 700 Palestinians have been killed in the past 2 weeks. 34 Israelis have died. The leader of Hamas, Khalid Mashal, has said he will not accept a permanent ceasefire unless Israel lifts its long-running blockade of Gaza. Lady Amos said she was extremely concerned about the deteriorating humanitarian situation.
We have over 118,000 people now who are sheltering in UN schools. People are running out of food. Water is also a serious concern. And of course, with about 44% of Gaza not able to be used by Palestinians that are fleeing their homes, the situation is even more dire.
The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has expressed his outrage and regret at the placing of weapons in a UN-administered school in Gaza. In a statement, Mr. Ban said that by doing so, those responsible were turning schools into potential military targets and endangering the lives of innocent children. The United States National Aviation Authority has lifted its suspension of flights into Israel's main airport near Tel Aviv, which it had imposed on Tuesday because of Hamas rocket fire. The restoration of flights by some European airlines into and out of Tel Aviv airport is expected to take longer. The remains of more victims of the Malaysia Airlines crash are to be flown from Ukraine to the Netherlands this afternoon. It's expected that the process of identification of the 40 bodies repatriated yesterday will get underway at a forensic facility in Hilversum today. The victims' families have been told it may be a long process. A special televised church service was held in the Netherlands last night for the victims of the crash. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop was among those attending. She said every effort would be made to ensure that the remains of all those at the MH17 crash site were recovered.
Together, the Foreign Minister of the Netherlands and I will meet with the Ukrainian leadership and discuss how we can logistically plan the securing of the site. We will not rest until we have counted for everybody, every Australian aboard that flight.
A prisoner in the US state of Arizona took nearly 2 hours to die after a lethal injection. The state governor has ordered a comprehensive review into the case of Joseph Wood, a convicted double murderer. It's the third time this year that an execution in the US has not gone as planned. In the days leading up to this execution, his legal team had argued that not enough was known about the drugs to be used. The same combination of drugs had been administered for an execution once before in Ohio in January, when it took Dennis McGuire 26 minutes to die. In Oklahoma in April, Clayton Lockett died of a heart attack after prison officials halted the process. Astrid Galvin, a reporter with the Associated Press news agency who witnessed Joseph Wood's execution, said attempts were made to stop it as soon as it became apparent that something had gone wrong.
What should have been a 10-minute execution turned out to last nearly 2 hours, during which Mr. Wood was gasping for air periodically. The attorneys for Mr. Wood actually left in the middle of the execution and went to federal court and filed a request for it to be stopped on the grounds that it had already been an hour and he'd still not died, but their request was denied. Some of the witnesses who had been witness to several other executions so that they had never seen something so excruciating.
Seven people have been arrested in North America and Europe in connection with a global cybercrime ring that defrauded eBay's online ticketing service in the United States of $1.6 million. One person was detained in Spain, three other people were arrested in London, two in the United States and one in Canada. They're charged with involvement in a scheme that used stolen credit card numbers to purchase thousands of tickets to events. The charges include money laundering, possession of stolen property, and identity theft. The Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. announced the arrests and gave details of the kind of tickets that were obtained.
These were tickets from some of the most sought-after events, for Justin Timberlake concerts, the Yankees and the Books of Mormon. So they were selling tickets related to orchestra seats, to sold-out Broadway shows, to seats behind the dugout at Yankee Stadium.
Now the time is 6 minutes past eight. The weather forecast, Mr. Fog, will soon lift. It'll be dry and sunny, but there'll be heavy and thundery showers with a likelihood of hail over the west later. Highest temperatures will range from 22 to 27 degrees.
Work is intensifying in the Middle East to broker a truce in the fighting, a truce at least, and a ceasefire at best. Today, the number of Palestinians killed has reached more than 700, and 32 Israeli soldiers and three Israeli civilians have died in the last 2 weeks. The US Secretary of State, John Kerry, has been meeting the main players since he arrived in the region on Monday. Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, is on the line line now from London. The Egyptians say rather optimistically that there will be a truce in place by the weekend. Shashank, what's your view?
Well, there's a distinction between a truce, a humanitarian truce, which Hamas says it's open to, and a ceasefire per se, which would bring the conflict to an end, which Hamas says it won't accept until at least some of its conditions are met, above all the opening of Gaza border crossings to allow goods and equipment to move in and out. And that doesn't look like it's on the cards just yet. Egypt, of course, it has to be remembered, under its new government, its new military-backed government, is very much against Hamas, and therefore it's not amenable to doing anything that would help Hamas out while it's being put under so much pressure by Israel.
Given the suffering that we've seen the Palestinian people going through in over the last 2 weeks, and indeed over the last number of years, how long can Hamas hold out in the face of that and also the ever-diminishing resources that they must be dealing with?
That's certainly true. For the last year, of course, don't forget that their supply networks, those underground tunnels that connect Gaza to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, have been systematically destroyed and targeted by the Egyptians. You know, it's Cairo that imposes a blockade on Gaza as much as Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. How long can they stand out? Well, their rocket stockpiles may be depleted. You know, they started with perhaps 10,000. That's probably gone down to below half of that, and it's difficult to replenish the better ones. They can make some of the middle-range ones inside Gaza. But I think there's a distinction between their military strength, which has been severely damaged, particularly their internal tunnels within Gaza, the ones they use to move stuff within Gaza and to attack Israel, not the Egyptian ones. There's a distinction between that and their political strength, which doesn't appear to have been damaged much at all. And the more that Israel has struck them, there appears to be no corresponding effect on how Gazans view Hamas. I think it's always difficult to judge, of course, because Hamas is an autocratic political entity. It doesn't allow dissent, and it punishes dissent. So it's very hard to gauge its popular support.
And then from the Israeli point of view, it seems from what they have done and what they have said over the last number of days that they have a job to do, closing off the tunnels, and that Israel won't stop until that job is done. Do you agree?
Well, no, I don't agree entirely, of course. This is an elastic aim. The initial aim of the operation was to restore deterrence. That was initially about rocket supplies and damaging those. And now it's become about tunnels. And there's no particular reason that tunnels were prominent at the beginning of this conflict. They've simply become very prominent because, in part, they were used last week for a couple of attacks. But there are simply too many tunnels. You know, the IDF doesn't have the intelligence across Gaza to know how many there are, exactly where the entrances are, where they go. So they can destroy them, but they can't destroy all of them. That would just require a complete reoccupation of Gaza, because many of the entrances are within civilian houses, are within civilian areas. So only a full-scale occupation could address that problem. Israel doesn't have the stomach for that, in my opinion. And so this conflict will end without a complete dismantlement of Hamas's military. That's a fact. That simply is what's going to happen. The only question is how much does Israel have to destroy before it can come away claiming victory? And if Hamas refuses to accept a ceasefire to the status quo and demands a lifting of the blockade, well, Israel isn't going to sit back and just accept the rockets, even if it pulls out. So you're going to have to see someone move on this.
So there will have to be, if there's a benefit for Hamas in any negotiated ceasefire, there's got to be a reciprocal benefit for Israel. So what could be offered, do you think?
Well, from Hamas's point of view, the benefit would be we'll stop firing rockets, of course. but I think, you know, does Hamas in some way look at a ceasefire as a kind of favour to Israel, rightly or wrongly? But what else can they offer? Well, don't forget the ceasefire that was signed in 2012, brokered by Egypt, that bought a couple of years of peace. Hamas actually did implement that ceasefire. It stopped other groups within Gaza, like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, from firing rockets. Now, that did break down a couple of times, of course, you know, in the summer of 2013. But on the whole, Hamas did guarantee a level of peace and stability for Israel, a freedom from rocket fire that you wouldn't have dreamed of 5 years before that, in 2006, 2007. So that's what Hamas can offer. They can offer peace, essentially.
And I see from a piece that you wrote 2 days ago that you criticised America for not getting involved quickly enough, but do you think that John Kerry is the right person to mediate this ceasefire if it does happen?
Well, look, he's the only real person. It's a shame that his standing in the region is so low amongst Egyptians, amongst Israelis, because of the failed peace process earlier this year, and amongst so many other people. And, you know, he does have a habit of putting his foot in it. But he's the only person who has that stature, along with Ban Ki-moon, to bring the mediators together. Because don't forget, the mediators themselves are at each other's throats. You have Qatar and Turkey pro-Hamas, you have Egypt anti-Hamas, and you need someone who can oversee these disputes, even amongst those who are supposed to be solving the fundamental dispute. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't just blame Kerry, I blame everyone. Look at Turkey. You know, Prime Minister Erdogan said that Israel was committing systematic genocide and compared it to Hitler. And by saying that, he of course excluded himself from any meaningful role. So mediators have to be more mature and long-sighted about these things and act much quicker before we have mass invasions of small, densely packed urban areas.
And do you expect that we'll see a humanitarian truce before we get to the ceasefire point?
Yeah, I think that's going to have to be a stepping stone. I think that's going to have to be a step, because Hamas won't stop, won't give a ceasefire, but what they might be able to do is give a humanitarian truce and say, we're not defeated, we're not stopping, we're just, this is for the people of Gaza. They might be able to sell that quite effectively. And in that time, we can use that time to then intensively talk between Hamas and the Palestinians, Hamas and the Israelis in somewhere like Cairo or Doha. And that time is sorely needed, because right now, we've all seen the awful statistics on the number of people dying, number of children dying every hour in Gaza. And so any truce that could buy time for talks is sorely needed at this point.
What do you make of the UN intervention in all of this and the mention of potentially investigating Israel for war crimes? Is that useful or not?
Well, my own opinion is that no state should be above the law. That includes established members of the international community, like Israel, but of course also European states and North American countries. But in practical terms, it probably won't help. Israel will judge it to be a case of the world pointing at it exceptionally over and above other states committing similar crimes. They'll say, well, the people pointing to us never pointed to Assad with as much vigor, and he has committed crimes on a far greater scale. So in that sense, I think people have to be more even-handed about how they point the war crime stick. But of course, if violations have been committed, it's imperative that both sides then are investigated in some fashion, because no army anywhere, and that includes the US and UK in Iraq or Afghanistan, should be above impunity.
Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you for joining us on the line from London. The members of the Oireachtas Banki inquiry have signed off on a blueprint on how the inquiry should run. It plans to examine Irish banking over the last 20 years in three modules and will aim to report back by the end of next year. Piers Doherty is the Sinn Féin finance spokesperson and joins us from our Derrybeg studio. Piers, is this rather ambitious that all of this work should be done looking at banking over the last 20 years and how we got to where we got to with our banking system, and that the final report will be ready by November 2015?
Well, I think it is ambitious. I think we have to remember that the banking inquiry, as the public understands it, isn't actually established yet. What the group that are the banking inquiry at this point in time only has to come up with a relevant proposal, which is in all effect terms of reference that would have to be agreed by the Houses of the Oireachtas. It would be only probably at the start of October that would be complete, and that the banking inquiry would be up and running. So you would have about a year to try and look at all of this area, to try and look at the three different modules that we've identified, from banking systems to regulatory systems to the crisis managed systems and policy responses, and to do that. Now, it isn't envisaged that we will look at the whole 20-year period, or indeed longer than 20-year period. What it is ensuring that flexibility in the terms of reference is there, that if the banking inquiry wants to look at a practice that may have happened, for example, in the mid-90s or late-90s, that it wouldn't be restricted in doing so as a result of putting defined time frame into the terms of reference.
How much disagreement was there yesterday in relation to the timing of inviting politicians like Brian Cowan in to give evidence?
Surprisingly, there has been very little disagreement so far in relation to the meetings of the banking inquiry. Obviously, people are coming at it from their own perspective. Would like to see it going different directions. But I must say the ad hoc group, which provided the advisory group, which provided the report yesterday, did a good job in summing up all of the different views of the members of the inquiry. One of the areas that we will be looking at later on is which of the modules will take place first, what what type of sequencing. But it's also important to remember that modules will be able to run concurrently, and some modules may be halted as a result of court action or maybe compellability of witnesses and documents. So therefore, the other modules may have to take place first. And that is a decision that will be taken at a later stage.
I mean, if you're Fianna Fáil and you're looking at this and you think, right, former Fianna Fáil leader will be brought in close, coming running close to perhaps election time, that might not be ideal if you're a member of that party. Is that likely to be an issue?
Well, I don't think so. The time frame that we've got is that there will be quite an intense period running across maybe 4 months, maybe longer, of public inquiries, 3 to 4 days a week, quite a number of hours per day, morning and afternoon sessions. So, you know, it's going to be within that window that all of these three modules will have to be examined. And it's important that we're able to be flexible with the modules. It's not envisaged that we will be taking in witnesses to appear in all three modules. When we have a witness before us, we'll question them and we'll question them across all three modules. So it's not a case of that there is one module with very defined boundaries and you stick within that rigidly.
Okay. It's 8:31. We'll come to the news headlines in just a moment. But I want to ask you about the Cabinet having its final meeting yesterday and going out really for the summer on a raft of good news. There was plenty there to welcome. Ploughing on with free GP care, a reduced budget adjustment and concessions on water tax.
Well, you know, anybody who's looking at that and families who are facing the €240 bill in January doesn't see it as good news. What they're seeing is how are they going to basically be able to pay for this additional charge that's coming. The government has been very strong in spin in terms of that this will be a budget that will give something back to people. But the first thing that people will recognise within 10 weeks of this budget is the new demand for water charges and followed closely within a couple of weeks by the full demand for the property charges. What we're hearing from government is about tinkering with the entry point to the marginal tax rate, which only will benefit 1 in 6 workers in the state. 1.8 million workers will not benefit at all. And I think that gives an example of where the government's priorities are. This, we welcome the fact that the government have seen sense that a €2 billion adjustment isn't required. We would rather, if 12 weeks out from the budget, that they stop playing this game and actually say how much they believe that the adjustment is at this point in time. They have the whole resources of the Department of Finance, the revenue behind them. They should spell it out clearly so we can have a transparent budgetary process where the opposition can show that there is a fair way to meet the adjustment and boost economic activity at the same time.
All right, and the Minister of Finance would say that it's too soon to tell just yet. Now, it's just coming up. Thank you very much, Piers Doherty from Sinn Féin.
The US Federal Aviation Administration lifted restrictions on US airlines flying into and out of Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv in Israel. The restrictions were put in place after a Hamas rocket landed close to the airport on Tuesday. The move was strongly criticised by the Israeli government, which has insisted that there is no security threat at Ben Gurion. But many flights remain cancelled today. EasyJet cancelling 16 flights into and out of the airport. Rafi Sella runs a transport and consultancy firm, AOR Challenges, which is based in Tel Aviv, from where he joins me. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Why do you think the FAA has changed its position?
Yesterday, when we talked with some of your people, I was a little bit hesitant to say it's a political decision. Now it's a proof, because FAA has banned flights and then lifted it with actually nothing, absolutely nothing changing between Tuesday and today. The problem is, of course, that FAA doesn't have the ability to actually order canceled flight. The FAA is a safety regulator, not a security regulator. They have no people, no understanding, and no merit in understanding what airport security or corridors of flight security are all about.
I think they would disagree with you fundamentally on that. I think they would disagree with you fundamentally on that. And I think that they probably understand what a rocket landing within a kilometer or so of an airport means.
Yeah, but they don't have the authority to decide it. That's what I'm trying to tell you. They are a safety, a flight safety, airport safety, not security. Security you have to have, you know, organization like MI5, Scotland Yard, FBI, CIA, I mean, people who are in the security business, to understand what the threats really are in airports and to and from the airport, flying in and out. And that is not the role of FAA, I'm sorry.
Isn't it impossible for Israeli authorities to say that Ben-Gurion is 100% safe?
No, nobody says 100%. There is no 100% safety. But there is a level of security that permits flying without the risk of flying as it is, just flying an airplane. And what I'm trying to say is that there are airports around the world that are so critically dangerous to fly in and out from terrorists' point of view that Ben-Gurion stands way above everything else. And what I can tell you from my own knowledge is that there is no airport in the world that is protected like Ben-Gurion.
What about the impact of Ben-Gurion being closed? Because many people will say not only Israeli pride has led to the reaction and the condemnation of the closure or the cancellation of flights, but also an economic reality as well.
Of course. I mean, you know, we have ports and airports, which actually brings us to the world. We don't have a land way of going out of Israel. So basically, you know, not flying in and out of Israel is a big economic problem in Israel. And as I said before, I think it is a political ability to try and pressure Israel. Although Israel can't be pressured on this because we do have national airlines that can pick up we need.
But do you deny the reality that a rocket landed within a very close distance of Ben-Gurion?
That is something that people who are not in the business of security have difficulty understanding. You have to understand that there are above 2,000 missiles that have been aimed at Israel and have actually done very little damage and have been and did not disrupt the regular life of people in the state of Israel, which Hamas wanted to do. Now, the system that protects the Ben-Gurion airport is 100%, that I can say, is 100% protecting it against missiles.
You said 100% happened, couldn't be guaranteed previously. I mean, the reality...
No. I'm saying missiles, not security. Missiles. The missiles that are sent towards the Ben-Gurion airport are a very... The airport is so well protected, and it has redundancy over redundancy over redundancy. What happens in that system is that the system has a way of knowing where the missile is going to hit. And somebody made a decision, I don't know if it's good or bad, that 1 mile out of the end of the runway, it's not the airport, it's the end of the runway of the airport, is not very dangerous if it falls. And they made a wrong decision because it fell on a house. The house was destroyed, but nobody got hurt. But as an expert on security, the Israeli aviation security person, who was the former Israeli head of the Israeli Air Force and a pilot himself, he should have been consulting with, I don't think FAA, but if FAA wants to make that decision, they should at least talk to him and find out, you know, what the threats are, how can they be mitigated, what are the other venues of airplanes to fly in and out of Israel securely. That hasn't been done. They just decided that because a missile fell 1 mile out of the airport, okay, that this is dangerous, and up they close all flights into Israel. And then today, nothing, really, I'm telling you, nothing happened, and they opened it up.
All right, Rafi Sella, transport and security consultant in Tel Aviv. Thank you for that.
Des has come back once again. We're glad to see you again.
Well, I hadn't intended leaving, Claire, but anyway, we've a busy night tonight for Irish clubs in the Europa League, and and hopefully their morale won't be dented by what was a very bad night for the champion St. Patrick's Athletic last night. St. Pat's crashed out, losing 5-0 in Tala against the Polish champions Legia Warsaw. The Pats manager Liam Buckley said they simply forgot to play in the second half and lost their shape. Now, they weren't helped by Ken O'Mahon getting injured in the warm-up, but 1-0 down at half-time, the visitors went on to score four more in the second period and comfortably progressed to a tie with Celtic next week. This was the reaction of St. Pat's Killian Brennan.
We really got put to the sword tonight, I have to say, after the second moment in. To be fair, we fell apart and it wasn't easy, and the lads, look, it's so despondent in the change rooms, but look, we're out of Europe. Had to pick it up on Saturday for it long, I suppose. It's going to be hard, but that's what we're going to have to do.
It is a different level, of course, Champions League qualifiers, but you played so well in Warsaw last week, you really gave yourselves a chance. Do you think there was too much talk about Glasgow Celtic and not enough talk about this match?
It's hard to say, to be fair. I think the opposition that we played tonight, it was a different opposition to what we played in Warsaw, even though pretty much the same team. The up to a level, I think everyone has seen that, they've seen the game the other night. But look, we're disappointed. I don't think it was a 5-0. I think when the second one went in, we chucked it in, to be fair, and it's not like us. But we had to dust ourselves down and go again Saturday.
Now, the result serves as a warning to Sligo Rovers, who host Rosenborg of Norway tonight. Like St. Pat's, Sligo achieved an excellent result in the away leg. They won 2-1, so there'll be a huge crowd at the showgrounds for the game, which kicks off at 7 o'clock. Now, Sligo captain Alan Keane has been talking to Adrian Eames about their chances of making history.
Yeah, it's all about seeing out the job. They're a good side. We stuck to the game plan. So we've worked on them this week. We've seen them enough, like, you know. So hopefully we can come along and probably see the tie out. It's going to be difficult because they're technically very good.
And I presume a good start is very important. It's important not to concede as well early on.
That's it, yeah. We've got to look and try and nick a goal and even trying to stay in a 0-0. Even get into half-time 0-0 and start taking in little segments, you know. I think that's what we kind of done last week. So I think everyone's focused. It's a chance to make a history as well for the Sligo Rovers Football Club.
Good luck to them. Dundalk and Derry are also in action. They face a very difficult task, though, away from home. Derry 1-0 down, going to Shakhtar Soligorsk, and Dundalk are 2-0 behind. They play Hajduk Split. Now, the Irish women's under-19 team are in semi-final action in the European Championships. It's been a great journey so far. Dave Connell's side take on the Netherlands in Oslo at 6 o'clock. And the Irish coach has been talking to Gareth Maher about the credit they deserve.
They certainly do. They haven't let anybody down. In fact, they've probably surprised a lot of people, not us, because we knew how hard they were working coming into this, and we've shown that along the way. Started off with a great win against Spain, which I feel was fully deserved. Fought back against England and Sweden, coming from a goal down on both occasions, getting four wonderful goals in those two games. So we're showing a lot of good play, defending well, and that's what we'll need against the Dutch.
Now, elsewhere, there were friendly games overnight. Manchester United were 7-0 winners over Robbie Keane's LA Galaxy. Ander Herrera, the new signing, was the star, and there were two goals apiece for Wayne Rooney, Ashley Young and Reece Jones. Danny Welbeck got the other. The attendance at that game, 86,500. Liverpool lost 1-0 to Roma in Boston, and Tottenham were 3-2 winners over Toronto. In cycling, it was the toughest day so far of this year's Tour de France, and Ireland's Nicholas Roche made a gallant effort to win Stage 17. But in the end, victory went to his teammate, the 21-year-old Pole Rafa Majka, who now takes the King of the Mountains jersey. Overall, Vincenzo Nibali continues to lead, his advantage some 5.5 minutes. The good times continued for Wexford Hurling last night. They won the Leinster Intermediate Championship, beating Kilkenny and Nolan Park by 2-11 to 14 points. Antrim were easy winners over Down in the Ulster Under-21 Hurling Final, and Kildare beat Wicklow by a point in the Leinster Under-21A Final. Today's golfing action is split between the Russian Open and the Senior British Championship in Wales. In the early stages of the Russian Open, Damian McGreen is going well. He's one shot off the lead, 2 under par after 8 holes. Simon Thornton is 1 under. Kevin Phelan is 1 over par. And we have 2 race meetings this evening, Limerick at 5:35 and Leopardstown Summer Thursday at 5:25.
Great weather for the races as well, Des.
Well, the High Court has issued an order to liquidate Bearhaven Credit Union. The instant closure of the credit union has come as a shock to its 3,500 members. The central bank sought the order, saying the credit union's financial problems were as a result of what it called poor governance. Charlie Weston is the personal finance editor of the Irish Independent and is here. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
Brian.
Could this not have been averted?
Well, yes, you would think so. This is the first time that the Central Bank has actually gone into the High Court and ordered the winding down of a credit union. They've been in the High Court before, but what they did was transfer the operations of the credit unions. You know, in Newbridge's case, the money was transferred into Permanent TSB, and then you had Houghton Sutton Credit Union, which was transferred or merged into Progressive in North County Dublin. So this is an actual wind down. The accounts are going to be closed. The savings accounts are going to be returned to people. There's going to be no credit union in Bearhaven, in Castletown Bear. So it's quite a dramatic step to have taken. Could it have been saved? There's been ongoing efforts for years to try and arrange a merger. I understand it was with Bantry, which is a credit union the nearest one, really. And what it cost about $3.5 million, I understand, to do that. But the Central Bank decided that it would cost half of that to liquidate it, so cheaper to liquidate it. Now, considering it cost about €54 million to push Newbridge Credit Union into Permanent TSB, $3.5 million doesn't seem like an awful lot of money.
When you think what was spent bailing out banks.
Well, exactly. You know, and all of the things that were wrong with this credit union, they tick all the same boxes for banks. Bad lending, poor governance, poor internal controls. You know, interconnected party loans, all of those things were a problem with banks, but we kept them going. We stuffed $64 billion in there, so we weren't able to find $3.5 million to save this, it seems. And the problem is that it creates shockwaves across the whole credit union movement. There's nearly 3 million people who are
just
members
to get
of credit
clear,
unions.
Who does it come down to saying, oh, well, it's cheaper just to liquidate it? Is it the Central Bank makes that decision?
Yeah, Central Bank, they have a special resolutions unit, and they have prepared a report that was given to the governor. It's a very long report. Much of it is redacted, that was handed into the High Court yesterday, and the decision was made on the basis of this document and the conclusions arrived at in that after 4 years of struggling to kind of turn this credit union around to get it on a proper footing, to improve its governance and its deficit, that the best thing to do was to wind it up, to actually liquidate it.
Okay, and the 11 million or so in savings that's there will be given back to its members. There's no question there, but I am thinking about people who might have money in a credit union this morning saying, I'm wondering, is my credit union okay?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're assured that this is an isolated incident, that this was a particularly badly run credit union that had problems for a number of years, a lot of big loans, loans to people connected with credit union as well. And we're told that, look, there are other credit unions with problems. There's about 100 credit unions on a watch list in the Central Bank, but they're being kept on a close watch, and that these will be resolved. Now, what's happening, the state is trying to encourage credit unions to come together to form stronger units. There's a body called REBO, the Credit Union Restructuring Board, which has been given state money to try and encourage credit unions to come together and form stronger units. Because, you know, this is a very small little credit union in Castletown Bear, very weak. On its own, it struggles. If it had been merged, this model of merging could be encouraged, because they're all individually owned and run. If they could be encouraged to bulk up, as it were, it would make them stronger as a kind of force.
So what of Castletown Bear now? I think 40 kilometres away is the closest credit union to it, and Castletown Bear is a place that would have quite an amount of cash and money being earned and wages being paid in the form of the fishing industry.
Exactly. A lot of fishermen with you know, cash earnings who had big deposits in this credit union. This money that was in savings will be automatically returned to people under the state deposit guarantee. Within 20 days, the money will be returned. The liquidators will go in, they'll look at the ledger and the files and see who had savings and return that money to them. If you owe money to Castletown Bear, the terms and conditions don't change. You'll have to just pay the money back. The liquidator will be writing to those people telling them you still
right,
owe the
so
money.
Right, so if you have an €8,000 loan with the credit union, what will happen?
You'll still owe that money. Now, the problem with this credit union is that there were a lot of very, very big loans. There were multiples of €8,000.
Right.
Loans for properties, including properties in Bulgaria and Spain, etc. But you'll still owe that money. It'll just be the liquidators who'll be chasing you this time instead of the credit union itself.
All right, Charlie Weston, thanks. Let's speak to Noel Harrington, who's Fine Gael TD for Cork South West. He's on the line. Noel Harrington, it was no secret that there were issues with the Bearhaven Credit Union. Could something not have been done politically to try and save it?
Okay, good morning, friend. Look, I think the first thing we have to be very, very mindful here is the sensitivities with staff whose futures now are very uncertain, and the savers whose deposits will be returned in full. Your question seems to go back to should politicians interfere with the central bank decision-making process. I think we've seen the results of that from the previous governments. and I don't think that's appropriate. What I would prefer to see is an effort to maintain a credit union presence in Castletown there. I live about 7 or 8 doors up from this credit union, and the loss of the credit union to Bearhaven and the Beara Peninsula is huge. So I think looking back and say, can the government interfere? No, it can't. And the central bank made that quite clear.
Well, what's your view of the central bank decision?
I'm unclear as to why they took the decision. It seems to be a very marginal decision in respect of the viability of the credit union. Now, we are aware that the credit union was essentially fighting with one hand behind its back because of the restrictions that were placed. For example, it really couldn't lend anymore. It couldn't lend at all, to be honest, except a maximum of €3,000, and only then to a saver who had €3,000 or more in shares. So it really was completely restricted in how it could do its business. And it couldn't in any shape or form come back to a viable situation under those circumstances. The cost is one factor, but I'm more interested in knowing what was the process involved between the Credit Union Board, the Irish League of Credit Unions, the Register of Credit Unions, and the Special Resolution Unit of the Central Bank. Every one of these boards and agencies had a role to play, and also a neighbouring credit union where the transfer was being offered. There's a whole raft of different options that may have been looked
at. You say you're interested to know. Is there any way to find out?
Well, that would be a matter. I think I'd love to get the opinion here of the Irish League of Credit Unions, for example, because I do know that a neighbouring credit union found, looked at the governance in this particular credit union, and the due diligence that they required simply made it so unpalatable that they couldn't get the transfer over the line. But where was the support from the Irish League of Credit Unions in this regard? I mean, they're something that was such a marginal decision, in my opinion, I'd love to know what the communications line, what was the chronology, what was the decision making within that organisation. And also with the Registrar of Credit Unions, who imposed draconian restrictions on Bearhaven Credit Union that it couldn't possibly fight its way to a viable situation.
Do you think there needs to be some examination, perhaps by an Oireachtas inquiry, of how a central bank decision can lead to the closure of a credit union serving a geographic area around the size of County Louth on the Beara Peninsula, 4,000 people?
Look, the legislation under which the central bank operates with respect to credit union is the 2011 Act. Whether they acted appropriately or not, they take into account public interest. And they will say that public interest was served here because they were to wind down this credit union rather than assign it or have it transferred. That does not take into account the social impact that the loss of this credit union has. But that is a matter now, I think, for I think discussion between certainly the community to get involved, Irish DSA Union, and to see exactly what further measures could be taken. I have called and I've spoken to the Minister's office yesterday to see if there's anything that the department could do within the Act and legally and would not impact on the regulations to see how a union presence could be maintained in Castletown there to benefit the wider Beara Peninsula.
All right, Noel Harrington, Fine Gael TD in Cork South West. Thank you for that. Apologies for the poor telephone line there.
Today could be the hottest day of the year, but as most people enjoy the sunshine, for some, extreme temperatures can be challenging. And Eamon Timmins from Age Action Ireland is with us in the studio now. And Eamon, you're here to tell us to keep an eye on elderly neighbours and perhaps to give some advice to those who are elderly. Why is the heat a particular problem?
Well, obviously the heat is fantastic for all of us, and we welcome it, and many older people are out there enjoying it. But for a small group of older people, the heat is really challenging. We're talking about people who might have respiratory or heart problems, people on medications which reduce their tolerance to heat and their ability to regulate their heat. And we're urging people to call in their older neighbours, especially those living alone. We're most concerned about those living alone over the day to make sure that they're okay. We know that the heat can cause problems, and it does cause problems. Certainly we look at France in 2003 when there was a very prolonged heat wave and over 15,000 older people died in the space of a month or two. Mm-hmm. So we know that heat can cause problems and it does kill.
So in terms of specific advice then for older people?
Okay, so for older people listening this morning, there's a couple of things we're urging them to do. First, keep sipping on cold drinks throughout the day. It's very, very important to remain hydrated. Certainly, if you become dizzy or you're feeling unwell, please, please, please contact someone. Pick up the phone and raise the alarm. Don't wait for it to pass. To do your business early, certainly coming in this morning is a beautiful time of the day. It's a nice cool time of the day. So if you have to go out today and get your pension, get a bit of shopping, get out and do it early before it heats up. Certainly stay out of the heat in peak hours, and if you do go out, use sunscreen and cover up. At home, there's certain things you can do. Certainly without people, to have the windows open, keep the air flowing through the house. Pull curtains on a sunny side of the building to stop the building heating up, and turn off unnecessary electrical equipment in the house. But, you know, this weather's going to last for another day or two, and we'd urge people just to be good neighbours. The message is just be a good neighbour. If you're out this evening going for a walk, if you're out today enjoying the weather, just call in on an older neighbour.
And you mentioned people with particular health concerns who might have more of a problem with this heat. I would imagine certain medications as well would counterindicate with these temperatures.
Yeah, I mean, it really is people with respiratory and heart problems, circulation problems, people whose blood doesn't circulate as well as the rest of us. So their body is not regulating its heat as well. There are certain medications, the side effects of which make people less tolerant to heat and also kind of affect the regulation of the body temperature. People will know the medications they're on. They'll know if that's the side effect. But certainly anybody living alone with those conditions, if you have neighbours who have a heart or a respiratory problem, please, please, please call in on them today.
Okay, I want to ask you about another issue that Age Action has been involved in the last couple of weeks and months. And we know the government was carrying out a review of the free travel pass scheme, and you were urging them not to change it. Now, are you claiming victory in that you've been given a reassurance that nothing will change?
Yeah, we launched a campaign the end of June and we ended it on the 14th of July. In the government's statement of priorities on the 11th of July, they committed to the full retention of the travel pass scheme, and we welcome that very warmly. The scheme has been under review for the last 2 years. It was part of the package of measures required by the Troika. The review, our understanding is the review isn't complete yet, but we've got that. It's looking at a number of things, but including in the terms of reference of that review, our eligibility, our funds for the scheme, are the scope of the scheme.
But isn't that the problem, that the review isn't complete and it has yet to be published and we don't know what's in there? So despite the government saying to you, you know, it'll be fine, we won't touch it, they still have this report to come about, which has been 2 years in the making.
The review goes further than just the terms of reference I mentioned there. It also looks at fraud. It looks at, you know, the scope of the scheme, the value of the scheme. We and our campaign highlighted the importance of the scheme. I suppose what we didn't want to happen is what we saw happen last October, when they abolished the phone allowance and then threw their hands in the air and said we didn't realise the phone allowance was linked to the pendant allowance scheme. So what we did, we were interviewed as part of this review and we were aware of what they were looking at, including looking at introducing a possible charge for the card, restricting the form of transport you can use, restricting the hours in which you can use it. And so what we did was we highlighted, we went out and did research among our own members as to how they are using the travel pass.
So you're just happy, that it's going
we're
to be
satisfied
protected.
We can't get any more than a commitment than we've got in the statement of priorities. Okay. And we welcome that.
All right, Eamon Timmins from Age Action Ireland, thank you for joining us.
The Irish Examiner asks an interesting question today. How sick is your county? Not only does it ask the question, it answers it too. The newspaper's Catherine Shanahan is in our Cork studio. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Fran.
This is a pretty exhaustive study and you have a detailed supplement published with the newspaper today. County by county, you're looking at health statistics. What have you found?
Well, what we've done basically, Fran, is we've set out, as you said, a county by county sort of performance sheet of based on the statistics available to us across approximately 20 different health categories. And we found really very different results for each county. I mean, some counties seem to fare more badly when it comes to the cancer stats in terms of incidence and mortality. Some countries fare badly when it comes to infant mortality rates, breastfeeding rates, in terms of obesity levels, respiratory disease, circulatory disease. We don't draw any conclusions in relation to it, because if we were to do that, we'd probably never have got this publication out. But what we just do is, you know, the reader can sit down, he can have a look at his county or her county, see what the stats are, and what we're really hoping to do is that maybe it'll prompt further debate and maybe further research into why some counties seem to fare so much better in some areas or so much worse than others.
And just looking at some of the main points, Limerick is the highest rate of infant mortality, obesity is the highest in the border counties, Dublin has the highest breastfeeding rate, Cork City the highest suicide rate, and Carlow the highest number of lung cancer deaths in the country. Where are you getting these statistics?
Well, the sources of all the health data we used, and it was effectively a data mining exercise, are listed in our publication today. The CSO obviously was very useful to us. The report published by the Department of Health in 2012, the State of the Nation's Children, was very helpful. There's also a website managed by the Institute of Public Health called the Healthwell, and they do a lot of modelling of estimates and forecasts based on initial reference studies. We have the National Cancer Registry. We have, in terms of infant mortality, we have the National Perinatal Reporting System. So really, Fran, there's quite a broad range of sources that we looked at, and it's all published information. It's just was a case for us of drawing it together, putting it into a single publication and letting people have a look and draw their own conclusions in relation to it.
Yes, and you said that you're not reaching conclusions yourself, but the obvious question here for people who are living in some of those counties affected by some of those issues will be, why is this happening? This could be quite informative and useful in terms of policy, public education, public information.
Well, that's what we're hoping, really. You know, when we were researching this data, there was no one website we could go to or no one publication that we could go to that would, you know, outline all of the conditions on a county by county basis. So what we're hoping is that by just, you know, putting it all together, setting it out there, that, you know, people might raise a few flags that haven't been raised before. There might be a few PhD students out there that are looking for an area of research. You know, because we covered such a broad base, there was no way we could go into an in-depth analysis in relation to, you know, what the causal factors behind all of these different categories of health, you know, how counties performed. We couldn't examine all of that. But, you know, possibly it'll throw a few tasters out there and people may decide to research further into what's behind them.
You've avoided the temptation to do what most newspapers and media outlets do when figures like these come together to say A is worst and B is best. Why?
Well, I mean, I suppose with statistics, there's always a sampling error involved. There's always different approaches taken. There's different population sizes looked at. I don't want to be alarmist. I simply wanted to put out there what was available. And, you know, I don't see the point in sort of getting people worked up about it. Just let them look at it and decide for themselves what they think needs to be done. You know, maybe on a health policy basis, it might pinpoint areas where there's need for more public health campaigns, you know, where you need to encourage people maybe to participate more heavily in screening programs. You know, if you looked at where there's high prostate cancer incidence rates, maybe encouraging people to avail of screening more. Same in relation to breast cancer. What we did see also was that in relation to, say, the counties which have the Centres of Excellence for Cancer, we couldn't really draw any conclusions in relation to that either, because I suppose they're not in place long enough to have any long-term impact on the stats we looked at.
Catherine Shanahan, thanks for coming into our Cork studio this morning. That 31-page supplement with the Irish Examiner today.